I'm Lynn Neary, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, we'll focus on the relief efforts in Haiti and examine how the media chooses images to tell the story of that tragedy. That's in a few minutes. But first, here at home, the health care overhaul bill is going through the reconciliation process as Democrats in the House and the Senate work to smooth over differences about the services the plan should provide and how it should be paid for. And now a surprisingly tight race for the Massachusetts Senate seat, once held by late Senator Edward Kennedy, could jeopardize the entire plan. For more on the policy and politics of the health care overhaul, we're joined now by Pamela Gentry. She's a senior political analyst for BET. Also with us is Mary Agnes Carey. She's a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, an independent news gathering service, and she joins us from her home office here in Washington. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Pam, let's start with you. First of all, why is this special election in Massachusetts so important to the health care bill?
Right now, the Senate has a 60-vote majority in the Democratic Party. If, in fact, Martha Coakley is not able to win this seat, then what that will do is take away their filibuster-proof majority. This means that if, in fact, they bring this bill to the floor and they don't have all 60 Democratic votes, then what they'll have to do is go back into negotiations in the sense of trying to either lure a vote from the Republican side of the aisle, or it could open this up to where the negotiations and the bartering and could go back and forth endlessly.
Mary Agnes, what are the major differences then that remain between the overhaul measures in the House and the Senate?
Well, they're very different bills as far as the size of them. The Senate passed a bill that's about $871 billion over the next decade. The House bill is over $1 trillion. That's a key difference. Abortion is a key difference. In the Senate, abortion services could be covered through the exchanges, and again, these are marketplaces of choices for health insurance where consumers can pick what would like for health insurance. But if a plan covers abortion services, consumers would have to write two separate checks, one for the health plan, one for the abortion coverage. In the House, abortion services could not be offered through the exchange, and so that is a key difference. Financing between the bills, how they're paid for. There was an accord reached last week on the high-cost, or otherwise known as Cadillac, health insurance plans, but still the bills are very different. In the House, they place a surtax on the highest income folks. We're talking about $500,000 for an individual, $1 million for a couple. In the Senate, they're looking at expanding, making higher a Medicare payroll tax on individuals of about $200,000, making that a year, and couples who make $250,000 a year. They might open that Medicare, increasing the Medicare payroll tax to under an income, capital gains, but we have to wait and see how that shakes out. And then also on immigration, there's a key difference. In the Senate, undocumented immigrants would be prohibited from spending their own money to purchase health insurance. In the House bill, they would allow that to happen. That's another key point of contention.
And Pam, in the Senate version of the bill, as it was going through the Senate, concessions were made to individual senators. Nebraska's Ben Nelson, for example, to get his support. Is this reconcile bill also being held up by a few individuals, or are there whole blocks that need to be won over?
I think now they're down to more of the policy differences. One in particular in the Senate bill is how much of a subsidy. The Senate tends to not want to subsidize people purchasing this health care because you will be required to buy it. And so their amount that you would have to pay is a lot higher than the amount you pay under the House bill. So the House is offering, I think, a family in, you know, above the poverty level of, I think twice the poverty level now, would be paying maybe less than $2,000, where in the Senate bill they might be paying close to five. So that's a real bone of contention. And that's also the reason that the cost of the bill is under such debate. So I think one of the biggest things now that they've got to deal with in the Cadillac plans that you just mentioned, the other thing that they did do with this negotiation or the deal that they cut is they really just moved it out, I think, 5 years. It doesn't really go away. It will eventually kick in, but it will give them about 5 years before people who have those plans will have to bone up a tax most likely, or, you know, not be subsidized for it.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News, and we're talking about the status of the health care overhaul plan in Congress. We're discussing the issues with political analyst Pamela Gentry of BET and health policy analyst Mary Agnes Carey from Kaiser Health News. Mary Agnes, during the House and Senate debates over the bill, as you pointed out, language concerning abortion coverage was a very contentious issue. So tell us exactly where that issue now stands in both the House and the Senate, and the prospects for compromise there.
Well, I think that this is one of the toughest issues to resolve. Bart Stupak, a Democrat of Michigan, who really pushed the House language to absolutely prohibit coverage of abortion services in the health insurance exchanges, is adamant that he can still retain a lot of the people who voted with him and that this could be enough to bring the bill down. But abortion rights proponents in both the House and the Senate feel that it's critical to allow women to use their own money to purchase abortion services. And so that was the carefully crafted compromise. You mentioned Ben Nelson a moment ago, a moderate Democrat of Nebraska. This was a sticking point for him. He felt that if you could segment the money into a separate account and people could pay their own money to get access to these services, that would be a good compromise. Bart Stupak and the folks that are with him in the House feel that's not. I think this is one of those issues that they're going to have to resolve. It's going to take lengthy talks, and I think it's unclear yet what the final line will be.
I also think one of the problems with that is following the money. Anytime there's a federal subsidy or a state matching fund involved, the accounting process, you know, how they're going to legislate that. I mean, writing a regulation or writing a law that can tell you exactly how that money is going to be funneled is going to be as difficult as it is creating this policy. So I think once they even get to a negotiation, I think the hard part is going to be how do you follow the money and say whether, you know, where this money came from and how it went to this provider or that provider.
And Mary Agnes, what about this tax on the Cadillac insurance plans that give people really premium health care coverage? Unions were really opposed to this tax, but apparently a compromise has been reached. Where does that stand now?
That's correct. As mentioned earlier, it's been pushed out 5 years for collective bargaining agreements in state and local employees. So that tax won't hit them for 5 years. They raised the threshold to $8,500, rather to $8,900 for an individual policy and $24,000 for family coverage. Took steps, for example, that would affect all plans. It would exclude dental or vision coverage. Supplemental policies would be exempted from those high threshold amounts in 2015. The difficulty here was that for President Obama and for many Democrats in the Senate, they felt this tax on the high-cost plans is a critical step towards helping to control health care spending. The president made it clear about a week ago, as he has consistently, that he wanted this to be in the bill. As you mentioned, labor opposes it, so this was the subject of very intense negotiations. This agreement was reached last week, and the thought is 5 years from now that a lot of these unions will be able to renegotiate their contracts, and they will not necessarily have plans that would hit that cap for the tax, where they would definitely happen now. It may not be the case 5 years from now as they renegotiate their contracts. So it was a compromise to give each side a little bit of victory and to move the negotiations forward.
You know, given all the compromises we're talking about that have already been made, that are going to need to be made, you know, to what degree is this bill really meeting its original goal of expanding access to health care for a larger portion of the public?
Well, we talked about subsidies earlier. Both the House and the Senate bill provide subsidies up to 400% of the poverty level. They do it differently for different income groups. But the fact remains that if you set up a health insurance exchange, again, that's a key difference between the House and Senate. The House bill would have a national exchange with states only doing it if they met certain requirements in the Senate. A lot of senators there like the idea of state-based health insurance exchanges. But if you provide subsidies, people can purchase insurance in exchanges. The estimate is about 30 million people who don't have health insurance could buy it if the bill went forward because they have the subsidies. Both bills would make changes to the Medicare program, which is a very large buyer of services in the country. They would both expand Medicaid. Again, that's for the poor and disabled, Medicaid coverage. So to get to the goal of to expand health care coverage, it seems that if the bills go forward, proponents feel very strongly that that goal will be attained. There's different opinions about, for example, if it will control costs or not. There are different opinions and different studies about what it might do for the cost of health insurance for people who currently have it. The Congressional Budget Office predicted that group health insurance plans, most of us are in those at work, would increase either stay flat in cost or they might increase by as much as 3%. So a lot of this is unknown. You're tinkering with a sixth of the economy. It's $2.5 trillion a year. But many lawmakers on both sides of the Hill feel that there are so many predominant problems with the health care system that this might be the best shot at trying to fix some of those.
And Pam, just to conclude on a political note, beyond the potential for a filibuster, which is only in a potential at the moment, what options do Republicans have to stop this bill? Any other options?
Well, I think that the options that they're doing now is the bully pulpit, if they can get enough of the American public that's not supporting of it. I mean, people have to follow what their constituents want. But I don't think that everyone is opposed to health care reform that is in their districts and in their areas. So I do think it is probably in everyone's best interest to get a health care bill passed.
And if the Democrats lose the race in Massachusetts, can they save the overhaul plan?
Well, there are other ways that, you know, I wouldn't bore you with a lesson on how they can, you know, maneuver around this, but they are looking at now, the Democrats are looking at other ways that they could possibly push something through without any Republican support and without having a majority.
One thing I read about was that the House might just pass the Senate version of the bill and then they wouldn't have to reconcile the two
bills.
That's
correct.
Any chance that would really happen?
I don't think so, because there are certain things in the House bill, like expansion of the Office of Minority Health. There are certain things for public health services that the Tri-Caucus and that other small interest groups inside the House really want to make sure that they get a version into the Senate bill, that I don't think that would happen.
Pamela Gentry is a senior political analyst for BET. She joined us here in our studio. And Mary Agnes Carey is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, an independent news gathering service. And she joined us from her home office in Washington. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.